Today on the Monocle Weekly, Edition 73, we'll be asking what's next for Brazil as the country prepares to head to the polls today.
Lula's protégé Dilma Rousseff is far ahead in the polls, but we still don't know if she's going to get elected today.
That was Raul Juste Lores, business and economics editor at Folha de São Paulo. We'll also be hearing what the big themes are at this week's Mundial de l'Automobile, Paris's biennial motor show.
France, much the same as it is. The US are thinking that the way forward is electric vehicles, the new wave of technology.
That was Michael Tyndall, European automotive analyst with Nomura. And later in the program, we'll be talking to Richard Watson, author of a new book, charting the effects that the digital revolution is set to have on the minds of the next generation.
I'm not rejecting digital culture, you know, I'm not saying Google's evil. I just really think there needs to be a bit of balance.
And now from London, the Monocle Weekly with Tyler Brulé, Andrew Tuck and Robert Bound.
Hello, it's Sunday, October 3rd, 2010, and you're with the Monocle Weekly here in London. I'm Tyler Brulé, along with Andrew Tuck. Tuck.
I love it, you don't even know my name.
I know, sorry.
What's going wrong?
And Rob Bound, back from Italia. Buongiorno.
Ciao.
Come va?
Bene tu?
Sì, bene. We do the whole thing in Italian. I'm so
should.
Good. You're a week in Tuscany.
Exactly.
Changes a man.
You look great.
Thank you very much.
We missed you, though. We missed you in Milan.
Oh,
me and
Alessia,
yeah.
Yes.
It was Fashion Week last week.
Yeah.
And that's where we were there.
I don't think a lot of that melted through, seeped into Tuscany.
Even to Tuscany.
I was the best dressed man there. don't, because I don't need, I know what you're going
to
say.
No. What? We're not going to talk about the special underpants that came into the office this week.
Well, no, I wonder if
that was a lot of excitement in the office on, was it Tuesday, I think they arrived?
Yeah, well, when you came down onto the floor wearing them, it took people by surprise.
I was actually wondering who did take those underpants home. We should set this up. This is where we need video for the program, because we were thinking they're quite interesting from an engineering point of view. It's a boxer short.
Just a normal boxer short.
A normal boxer short, yeah. With a surprise inside.
What's that, a sort of bit of scaffolding inside?
Yeah, it's a bit of engineering inside. I've set it up. Tell us what happens inside, Rob.
So inside the boxer short, the normal exterior, inside it does look a bit like a scaffolding, something that is basically a fabric way of, well, producing an egg cup.
Exactly.
Is what we were talking about, wasn't it, in the office?
It was.
Something to put your eggs in.
Andrew, do you want to translate that?
How do you like your eggs in the morning?
For the lay consumer.
So that's a kind of little kind of handkerchief-sized piece of cloth that acts as a jockstrap and keeps your bits and pieces in their right place.
What, because
No peekaboo.
That's what I'm saying. It's an anti-peekaboo boxer, which is sort of a Sunday morning theme, because I think there's probably a lot of people listening to this morning, you know, who could have a peekaboo incident in their boxer shorts on the edge of the sofa in bed, right?
It could be happening right now.
Anyway, I think they need these French boxer shorts.
I think it's great because you have all the supposed advantages of a jock strap.
With a boxer short around it.
With a kind of vanity blanket around the side.
I think it's funny because I think the French are actually quite keen on innovation in underwear.
Yeah, they are.
Especially in the men's department, which is the one department you don't want to innovate.
No, I mean, there's always something that looks like a slingshot by a brand called or something like that.
I was going to mention Om. It's like the oddest collection.
They do.
Do you mind putting your trousers back on, please?
No, but it's funny. And also, Om always tries to have the small, like the tiniest packaging as well.
Yes.
Tiniest packaging for tiniest packages.
Yeah. You don't want to be seen buying them, do you?
No, in the department at Le Bon Marché.
Yeah.
Like, Canton. Should you do the whole show in
they're
French?
They're a bit small. They're a bit small. Oh, no,
I was in Germany this week.
Oh, we're going to switch to German now.
Yeah.
Is that good?
Wir können Deutsch sprechen. This week was DistroPress in Hamburg, which is the major global distribution conference for distributors of magazines and newspapers.
Were you saying something to the throng, or were you just...
I was.
Were you taking part?
I was doing one of the keynotes at the event, Why Old Media is New Media.
Nice. Did they
brought the house down. It really did.
Was there much slapping of thigh in Hamburg?
Something like that. Not really in Hamburg. I think that'd be more Munich. But anyway. No, it was interesting, though. I won't sort of, you know, sing our praises on this program, but we were in the ascent in most markets. We're the number one import magazine in Germany, you know.
That's nice.
And they weren't just saying that because we were in Hamburg.
And they weren't just saying that. They weren't slapping their thighs. They were telling the truth.
They were.
There was a lot of it. It was nice to see it. I had
70% growth in Hong Kong.
You are. You're doing what you said you wouldn't do, aren't you?
But when you get 70% growth, that's when you get peekaboo.
It's nice, lovely. Let's just move
Andrew's
along.
Andrew's on fire.
He is, isn't he? Anyway, I brought some magazines.
I love that. I love the cover of that brand.
Because I wasn't sure if Story of the Week was working anymore.
So you're just going. You've got three magazines, so you can do your three magazines.
Yeah. So what magazines did you bring?
I've got the Evening Standard.
Well, anyway, I always like picking up Brandeins, which is a German business monthly, which always does a fantastic job. And what was interesting is that there's also something of a competitor. I'm not sure if the editors of Brandeins would agree. But it's actually better than 70%. It's called Enorm.
That is good, isn't it?
And it's another business title. But my favorite one is a new one. This is a theme, actually. Talking about peaks, Alps, which is a new magazine out of Munich, and it just celebrates alpine lifestyle.
Oh, that's excellent.
I like that.
No, it's nice. It's beautiful. Maria's Nest.
But that's got nothing to do with underwear solutions.
It doesn't. No.
Enorm's excellent.
Yeah, I think Enorm is very nice, but I think there's something in Alps. I think the German market always won for a little bit of innovation.
I tell you what I like about Brandeins. It has a very kind of quite cold but wonderful style of photography.
It's very calm.
Yeah, it's very calm.
It's very calm.
Yeah, no one's moving around much in Brandeins. No.
Not a lot of movement.
No. Not one of those blurry ones.
Where else should we go in the world?
I don't know.
We should go to Brazil. There's a lot of things there today. Exactly. Yes, from Manaus to Florianopolis, Brazilians are heading to the polls today for a general election that marks the end of a rather remarkable era, both in economic and leadership terms, for the country, with Dilma Rousseff of President Lula's PT party up against Sao Paulo Governor José Serra's PSDB's. Both will have a tough act to follow after 8 years of President Lula's state-making. Raul José Loures is the business and economics editor at Folha de São Paulo in São Paulo, and he joins us on the line. Hello, Raul.
Hello, good morning.
Well, it looked like, at least for some stretch, that Ms. Rousseff was certainly in the lead. Is that the case this morning, as people are certainly heading off to their polling stations?
Yes. I think Lula's protégé, Dilma Rousseff, is far ahead the other candidate in the polls, but we still don't know if she's going to get elected today. She needs more than 50% of the votes, or if it's necessary a second round by the end of the month.
Certainly when we were visiting you last time in Sao Paulo, when we were talking about both Mr. Serra and also Ms. Rousseff, we were just asking people's opinions around the dinner table. Both said that there was certainly a lack of charisma, and of course Lula is a very tough act to follow. But what's happened since? Do you think they've polished their game? I mean, of course they're both seasoned politicians, but what's given Ms. Rousseff the lead, or what's threatening her now, do you think?
I think she got Lula's power and Lula's touch. I mean, Lula organized more public acts in this year, 2010, than in his last election in 2006. So, Lula knew that his candidate, his protege, wasn't the most charismatic figure ever. So Lula went on TV almost every day talking how she is the one poised to succeed his successful projects. And she tried her best to look like nice lady, a smiling lady, very different from the tough manager that everybody that had contact with her says that she is.
I mean, some would argue that maybe that's just what Brazil needs at the moment. As much as, a nice lady on the world stage, maybe it does need a tougher manager right now.
Yes, definitely. Yes, because, Lula was the political maverick who could create consensus from the businessman to the social movement, from the extreme left to the extreme right. He has 80% of popularity. But Dilma Rousseff somehow organized his second term. She was a kind of prime minister of Lula. So now it seems that in her government, if she really gets elected, Dilma will put her management skills on the road. But politically speaking, I don't think she will be as popular as Lula. And she is not so interested in the international arena as Lula. So probably the next years, we are not going to have some Brazilian president grabbing the headlines.
Hi, Raoul. It's Andrew. I just want to ask one question, which is what seems interesting about all the candidates is their past CVs, and actually they're quite old CVs. It seems very important what all the candidates did during the period of the military dictatorship. And I wondered if that's how important that is when voters, even today, go to the polls, what they did back in the 60s.
Actually, it's not. I think not only Brazil is a very young country, but we don't have a very good memory. I mean, Brazilians live the present and always claim that their country is the country of the future. But it's true that the three candidates are not from the right, what's very weird, to say the least. So the three candidates present themselves as center of left or left of center candidates. Marina Silva, the third favorite, she was a minister of environment in Lula's administration. And Serra and Dilma, they were exiled in the 70s. Dilma lived in France. Serra lived in Chile and the United States.
And as a consequence, I mean, all of them sitting over there, I'm wondering, when you look at Brazil Inc., and certainly, I mean, we've seen, where sort of, you know, Petrobras has sort of, you know, risen in terms of, you know, market valuation over the last week. I mean, it's extraordinary what happened. Is Brazil Inc., though, would you say, firmly behind Mr. Serra?
No, I don't think so. I don't think so. I mean, actually, I think that the left in Brazil learned a lot in these 8 years of Lula in power. So we don't have anything near a Chavez in Brazil that can get the power. So, I mean, Dilma, Serra, and Marina are free market-oriented politicians. They believe in capitalism. They believe in trade. And I don't see any big change of rules in Brazil, either Dilma or Serra gets elected. I don't think so. I mean, the three are from the left, but it's not the stereotypical Latin American left that you can see in Argentina or Venezuela or, of course, Cuba, that despise capitalism and despise international investments.
Raul, let me just ask you again. If you were a CEO right now, and it doesn't matter whether you were running an airline like TAM or you were sitting at the top table at Petrobras, who is Brazil Inc. voting for?
Clearly, it's clearly split. And why? Because, I mean, many sectors, many areas of Brazilian economy have boomed under Lula, and they have a very close relationship with Dilma Rousseff. I mean, all the electricity providers and distributors, infrastructure projects, etc., all these big real estate developers, I mean, they somehow trust more in Dilma, and they have a very good relationship with Dilma. Others, I would say, that prefer Serra, but much more it's about ideology in this case. I mean, some of Brazil Inc. don't like the Workers' Party. They still think they are too left for them, and that's why some of them will vote for Serra. But clearly, Serra is not the candidate of businessmen and Dilma from the poor. I think now it's much more mixed, and I mean, both the rich and the extreme poor have succeeded very well with Lula. So that's why I would say the middle class probably is going to vote for Serra, but many people in the elite and in the lower income classes are going to vote for Dilma. And that's why probably Dilma is going to get elected.
And finally, and whether it's going to be what, first or second round, do you think that you'll end up in a second round but still with Dilma getting there? What will happen by tonight?
Nobody knows. I mean, Dilma can win by, 50 or 51% tonight. But there were some corruption scandals in the last 2 or 3 weeks. And some of them harmed people very close to Dilma Rousseff. I mean, the former right-hand woman of Ms. Rousseff had to resign, actually, and she was the chief of staff of Lula. That somehow put some kind of noise, and Dilma had to fight. She was in a very comfortable position until mid-September, and now, I mean, some votes, especially in the middle class, they are fed up with corruption scandals, and that's why probably some of these votes have migrated to Marina Silva, the Green Party candidate.
Great. Raul Juste Loures from Folha de São Paulo. Always nice to talk to you. Thank you very much for joining us.
Oh, thank you. My pleasure. My pleasure.
Okay. Have a good day counting the votes or watching the votes anyway.
Okay. Thank you.
Bye-bye. Obrigado. Thank you.
De nada.
Andrew, do I always love talking to Raul because it always sounds sunny every time you talk to Raul. He's like the sunniest correspondent in the world.
I know, he's just got this amazing kind of voice, which you can't quite tell what the accent is because it's kind of very kind of proper in English in some ways, mixed with the great kind of dollop of Brazilian Portuguese. But he's great.
I think it should be a band when he talks about sort of Gilma, Sarah, and Maria.
Sounds good, doesn't it?
It does. Sounds
I'm
great.
Hearing maracas.
Absolutely.
I'm sure one of the words he used in the middle of that interview was the name of a small Welsh town, wasn't it?
Which was it?
Well, I don't know. It sounded very guttural.
Yeah, it was very guttural.
There's something in there.
No, brilliant.
We'll ask our producer.
Do you think it's it is time for a settle down period, Andrew? That of course we've just seen sort of, you know, the rise and rise of Brazil, and of course, I mean, the country's clearly been getting down to business. But of course, there's been some questionable sides in terms of Lula alliances, etc. And maybe it's good that it should just not be sort of, well, in a way, maybe just business as usual for a nation.
Yeah, I think it's interesting to see how the baton will be handed on. And I think that poor woman, she just doesn't really stand a chance against kind of Lula's reputation. It's been an extraordinary period. And when you see him going to, you know, going out of power with approval ratings of 80%, you know, in a country that's not a dictatorship, that's almost unheard of. And he's been an incredible, pragmatic manager of the nation. He's kind of empowered the poor, and he hasn't kind of alienated the rich or the middle classes. And when you're there in Brazil, as you know, we know ourselves, when you're in somewhere like Sao Paulo, there's a kind of real sense that the nation is coming together in a way that it's never done before.
Yeah, and but despite the fact, I guess, when we were there as well, that when you have this expanding middle class, that was, I think, the one surprising thing in the last trip, when you think that Brazil and the big cities are getting a grip on things. You know, in fact, expanding middle class actually means that there is, in a way, also more crime because there's more targets.
Yeah, but then I thought the other interesting stories that are unraveling in Brazil, when the media story just, you know, fascinates me, the sense that these newspapers, like the one that Raul works for Folha, you know, that it's an expanding readership, expanding sales, that as these people come into the middle class, what's interesting is that they do want to read newspapers, they do want to read books, that they want to kind of buy the kind of products that lots of us in the West have got a bit tired of. You know, it's an amazing moment for Brazil, and I know that we reflect it in our business pages, but you do kind of wonder, if you were an entrepreneur these days and you could speak Portuguese, oh God, you know, you'd think you're heading to Brazil to set your business up.
How are the classes going?
Very slowly.
What's that in Portuguese?
Yeah, exactly. Gentlemen, put your seatbelts on. We're off to Paris next. It's the auto show.
Clunk, click.
Cue sound effect.
Vroom.
Okay, nice.
Or vroom, vroom.
You can take
kind of that. In fact, it's all about electric cars in Paris. Do you know that?
Yeah.
Exactly. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. You're back with Monaco Weekly here in London. This weekend, Paris's biennial motor show, Mondial de l'Automobile, gets underway. So, is the race still on to master the perfect hybrid vehicle, or are attention-grabbing tie-ups with fashion brands set to steal the show? Michael Tyndall is European auto analyst at Nomura, and he joins us on the line from Paris to tell us more about the big themes. Michael, is it all about just the battery? Forget about the hybrid. The hybrid is, you know, very 5 years ago.
I think you're probably right on the money there. I mean, electric vehicles, particularly this being France, and obviously electric vehicles making a bit more sense environmentally, that seems to be the key theme for the show.
And is that partly just because of the Nissan-Renault alliance, or also because there are many other vested interests at play?
I think France, much the same as the US, are thinking that the way forward is electric vehicles, and they want their domestic car makers to be leaders in what is the new wave of technology. So in that sense, they figure this is a way to actually shore up what is a pretty challenged industry at this point.
We've seen a lot of pieces, if you spend any time, you know, looking at Bloomberg and certainly, you know, looking at sort of any of the sort of the major news and business wire outlets. I mean, there's been a lot of coverage, certainly over the last few weeks, comparative tables, looking at, you know, what one American brand's offer does versus a battery operated vehicle from Japan. Do you think there's going to be a different type of marketing sell that we're going to have to see?
You know, I think for me, the electric vehicles are all very much the same. I think the car makers would have us believe that there is
a degree of differentiation. I think there might well be in terms of battery technologies. But it's not as if this is something that's just been invented. It's been around as long as the gasoline engine. So in that sense, I think the consumer is just going to pick and choose based on brand perception and how it looks and whether or not it's the right image for them.
Hmm. I mean, obviously that means that the whole notion of performance, because obviously, you know, before it was clearly about horsepower, not how many volts, and it was, you know, how fast from sort of, you know, 0 to 100. But obviously, you know, performance means something very different now. And I'm wondering, you know, is that forcing a big rethink, you know, on the parts of marketing departments? Because as you're saying, you know, if I'm going to buy a battery operated vehicle, it's because I'm doing something good for the environment. I'm probably going to change my, you know, my driving habits because this is an urban vehicle. If I need to go long distance, I'm going to be going on the SNCF or I'm going to be using Deutsche Bahn to get there. So do you think that there is a real sort of rethink, or is there still room for good old performance still?
I think the people that are buying electric vehicles are probably the people that think performance statistics are in some ways antisocial. So I'd be more inclined that they'll be looking at battery range, they'll be looking at charging times, they'll be looking at, you know, what it says to the rest of the world about their view on the environment, which ironically, if you're using coal-fired electricity, you know, I'm not sure that there is a great benefit to the environment, but the makers of electric vehicles will have you believe that it's a zero emission and therefore it's good for the environment.
Yeah, that'd be a whole other program for us to delve into. I think my colleague Rob has a question.
I wondered about the vibe of Paris as opposed to Geneva or Frankfurt. Is there something that it's great at as opposed to the other places? Is there a sort of tradition of a particular type of launch at that show?
Not really. I mean, the same people are present. There's an emphasis more on the French brands here than there is in Frankfurt. I guess Geneva tends to be a bit more well-rounded, but...
So the girls are better really. In Paris or something? Is that why you've gone there?
I'm always here for the cars, only the cars.
Right.
Do you think that that's also changed, though, because whether you sort of go to the Tokyo Auto Show and it's sort of, you know, identikit, you know, Japanese girls who are all in sort of, you know, the same suits and sort of, you know, the same haircuts as well. I'm wondering also, you know, when you actually get to stand today as well, that, you know, as much sort of, you know, political correctness, you know, exists very much under the bonnet. I'm wondering what happens on top of the bonnet as well.
It feels like there's a change. I mean, I wonder to what degree, when you consider the average age of a car buyer in Europe is 49 and it's 30, for example, in China, whether or not different things appeal to different audiences. But certainly over the years that I've been looking at the sector, it's become more politically correct. It's certainly by no means politically correct yet, but it's definitely more than it was.
It's a crystal ball time, and you know, whether it's Michael Tyndall's own view, which might be also the view of Nomura, but where do you see, you know, the market broadly going? You know, is there still room for, let's say, not necessarily the irresponsible gas guzzler, but is there still going to be scope for, you know, whether it's BMW or Lexus, you know, who want to roll out their vehicle? Do the De Montezemolo family have to worry about Ferrari, or there's still going to be scope for that as much as Nissan can be excited about the Leaf?
I think in the niche, there'll definitely be. So, I mean, I think Ferrari, Lamborghini, the high-end performance cars, there's always going to be a market. I think when you move down the tree a little bit towards the BMW, Mercedes parts of the world, I think they're going to have to be increasingly more fuel efficient. Governments are not going to let them get away with emitting too much. So in that sense, I think we will see a shift within the industry. I think all car makers are going to have to produce more fuel efficient cars, even Ferrari.
Great. Well, Michael Tyndall from Nomura in Paris, thank you very much for joining us.
No problem.
Enjoy the show.
Thanks very much. Bye.
It was remarkable just listening to, you know, the China 30 years old and in Europe 49. And I know, I'm wondering whether, you know, we will see a concerted effort on the part of the manufacturers, you know, not just, you know, the pitch of the vehicle, but again, I go back to sort of the marketing and advertising to try to sort of lower that number.
Yeah, I think there's so many kind of demographics kind of hitting the kind of car market in Europe. I think that what's also fascinating is that for a younger generation, actually, especially the most urban kind of based generation, and if they're reasonably middle class, actually, they don't want a car. That's the funny thing, that in a city like London, Yeah, there's so many people, even in our office, who they don't have a car and they don't need a car because they rely on public transport. They find it too expensive to run. There's literally nowhere left to park it. It's not safe to park a car. So there's a kind of an urban generation around the world that's become a bit disenchanted.
But do you think that's a London issue? I mean, I'm wondering, do you think that, that someone in Hamburg or... Yeah, in Geneva is having the same issues because in Geneva they want to drive up to Verbier for the weekend.
Yeah, maybe, but I think in lots of, you know, that may be an exception, but I think in actually in places like Munich, in Berlin, the same debate is going on because people, that's why companies like Daimler are looking at car sharing schemes and how they own those schemes rather than get divorced from the car market by them being taken over by some other kind of, you know, letting agency, whatever. So I think that there is a whole generation that is not quite sure of their relationship with the car in the way that, you know, our parents were, and that who certainly don't think of themselves as being defined by their car as, you know, as many people were kind of 20 years ago.
What's your relationship with the car, Rob?
We had a pretty good relationship with the car until I ended up upside down in a pond in one.
Seatbelt on or off?
Yes, luckily my seatbelt was on. Like, my car was actually so old, it actually only just had a seatbelt. But I think there's an interesting discussion about the sort of models you use to advertise a car to the Chinese and a car to the European market.
Well,
whether, like, for the Chinese, they feel like, I want to sort of have an affair with this woman, whereas for the European market, you essentially want a model that's attractive, yet could probably knock up a fairly decent shepherd's pie as well. I think this is probably how the casting couch is changing.
Definitely.
Yeah.
And I think it's the cut of the skirt in China too, as well.
Andrew rolled his eyes at that, by the way.
Yeah,
he literally rolled his eyes.
No, but I think it is interesting because, and I think there's also sort of, you know, the selling. I haven't had a car for a few years, and as you know, Andrew is saying, it's like you just do not feel the need to have one in London. But the reason why I was challenging you is because some people, and when we chat to, you know, friends in other European cities, like, God, you know, I couldn't imagine, you know, living life even with the city, you know, without a car, and they find it that it's, you know, it's absolutely essential. But I was on the train the other day. No, I'm sorry, I was in a car. I was in a car going from Milan up to St. Moritz, and I was just thinking there is something about the grand tour, and there's something about, you know, okay, and you're right, it's not sort of the clogged urban streets of London, but the wide open road. I'm like, God, you know, I would like to have an Audi in my garage again, like I used to in Switzerland.
Yeah,
can you sort that out for me, please?
Okay, I sort that out. Those are kind of
November 25th,
the rare kind of driving moments. But I am someone.
November 25th.
Okay. It's dinky again, mate. I'm one of those people that do have a car in the office, and actually, I don't use it.
I haven't seen it parked by your desk.
No,
it's tiny.
It is a dinky.
Well, it's a pedal car. My little feet are kind of going rapidly.
Yes, you have a car.
And I don't use it. Mm. It sits there because, you know, actually, it's just boring moving it and trying to park it. And, you know, I find the whole experience in London boring. So I'd rather actually go on a bus or go on the subway even now, often than take my car on a journey it seems feasible. I'd only ever use it, you know, at night or when I was leaving the city when it was just really inconvenient to get public transport.
Let's say, just for the sake of argument, that we had a new office and there were 12 parking spots.
Okay, I'm coming to work by car.
Okay, I'm going to buy one.
Beep, beep. You listen to the Monocle Weekly. We're back after this. You're back with the Monocle Weekly here in London, where it's time for Culture with Robert Bound and also Andrew Tuck and me, Tyler Brulé. Hi, Rob Bound.
Hi.
How are you? You've changed seats.
I'm just over here. Hi,
still
here.
It was a very short sting that we had, and you were able to go from that seat to that seat.
I know. Imagine how long, if it was a longer sting, imagine where I could be.
I know. I had to put my glasses on. You're so far away.
Get your binoculars out.
I know.
We need a longer piece of music. I'll be down in the Green Man.
What do you have for us today?
I've got two things for you. I thought we often are in New York, we're often in London, we're often in Sydney, in Tokyo with our music. I thought we'd go to two neglected places. So we're going to Syria first.
Ooh.
Well, London and Syria, but mostly Syria.
Are we in Damascus, Aleppo?
We're on the road to Damascus.
Fantastic.
We are in Damascus.
Okay.
It was recorded in both those two cities, London and Damascus. And it's by a band called Syriana, who is a man called, this is going to test me. You can hear the paper flicking, can't you?
I can. I didn't like the French bit where I had to say Mondial de l'Automobile.
I don't know how to pronounce this. He's called Nick Page. Oh, that's the easy one. Nick Page and a Syrian virtuoso khanan player called Abdullah Chideye. And a khanan is an 81-string Islamic dulcimer. It's like a sort of guitar. So anyway, they're called Siriana.
And how do you play it standing up or is it on your lap?
I don't know. You probably need about five blokes to carry it.
Let's maybe
you
can.
It sounds like you probably have to play it like you're bearing a coffin. Exactly. I'd imagine with a few other people around it. And this track is called Habib, which means stranger.
I liked that.
It's made the hairs rise on the back of your...
Where?
Neck. Rather beautiful, that, isn't it?
It is.
Really
very
lovely.
Nice.
Yeah. It's amazing how there's all that kind of almost like cinematic, you know, kind of epic quality to those. Mm. It reminds me of like those really old like Kulthum songs. It's wonderful.
Yeah, it is. Well, that album, that's a great album, actually. It's going to be reviewed.
Is
next
it?
Issue. And it's called The Road to Damascus. It does
feel
like
it is called The Road to Damascus.
It's called The Road to Damascus, that record. Brilliant. And it does sound like the soundtrack to a road movie. It really does. So that's that.
Okay. Now where are we going?
And in other weird places news, well, not that weird. We're going to Omaha, Nebraska.
Okay. So I've been to Omaha.
Have you? What's that like?
I was on my way. I was driving from Winnipeg to, we were on our way to Denver. And then, well, we were on our way to Denver, Colorado. Then we were going skiing. But it's pretty much straight down all the way. Omaha.
Did you do anything in Omaha? Did you have a particular, did you eat?
No, stop for pee.
Okay. Well, let's hope this is not better than that.
I'm stepping out of the room right now.
There's a review. This is to prove really that perfect pop music, perfect rock and roll always comes from the coldest places normally. This is a guy called Tim Kasher, and the track is called Cold Love. Maybe we're getting older. Yeah, maybe our hearts are beating slower. Or maybe we got tired of the same old desert. We grew up in a world of 31 flavors. Yeah, maybe we're just tired of this vanilla existence. Cold love is all that we know. Cold love, no words, no emotion.
I don't know. The Road to Damascus sort of trumps the Road to Omaha, I think.
All right.
I was telling you. It was fine, but I mean,
cold
it was
love,
like,
you always feel better, don't you? You always feel warmer when you have a wee. Like you probably
maybe
did
maybe
in Omaha. It's one of those facts.
Yeah, I don't know. Andrew, what do you think?
Yeah, I think it's one of those things, it's not really fair to them because it's the wrong way around. Because you can't beat the Road to Damascus after that.
Well, they're two different, but that's the point.
I know. We love the diversity. I think it's great.
I think we need more of it.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Okay.
Anyway. Sorry.
No, but it's good. No, it was good. And I just think, you know, old world, new world.
Precisely.
Loved it.
Tim Kasher, though, he's good, isn't it? That's good metronomic kind of rock and roll.
It is.
I like it.
But no, I would love sort of a whole sort of evening mix of Road to Damascus.
Do you think there's a huge number of them?
They're a massive collective. They're two people. There's two guys that are the band, and then
three support buses.
Even with an 81 string Hunan,
yeah.
You're like, well, I tell you what,
should we have a Hunan in the office?
I might have got that wrong. I think it's called a Hun.
A Hun. I like Hunan better.
Hunan. Isn't that that's
it's got
that,
96 strings?
That's that Chinese restaurant, isn't it? That
yeah, maybe it is.
Hunan. I think it's a province of China.
Or it's another one of the cities in China we haven't heard of, but has 80 million people.
Yeah. All of them buying cars because of the right looking women.
Exactly.
They don't look like they can cook.
No, they're all 30. On that note, we're going to break. You're listening to the Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to the Monocle Weekly here in London. A new book out next week asks if the digital revolution is destroying our ability to think for ourselves and whether media trends are fostering an unhealthy addiction for the next generation. Focusing on the effects that screen culture will have on today's youth when they enter the workplace, Future Minds claims we are in danger of raising a generation that has plenty of answers but few good questions. The author, futurist Richard Watson, joins us here in studio to tell us more. Richard, at the starting point, was it you were trying to hire an intern and they were just too Generation Y, and as you were sort of asking the questions, they sort of couldn't quite focus? Where did this all start?
That was part of it. It actually
actually goes back years. I was quite interested in doing a book about how physical spaces influence thinking and particularly ideas. And that sort of came to me on the top floor of the Intercontinental Hotel in Sydney, actually, having a sip of a glass of wine, staring out to the heads over the ocean. And the thought never really went away, but it got reorientated a bit towards digital culture and screen culture, which is a little bit more pressing as an issue, I think.
Hmm. And so what was it, just sort of, you know, the Sydney heads that did it?
I think it's got something to do with scale and something to do with a horizon. You know, I don't think you get big thoughts. I'm not saying this is necessarily a big thought, but, if you're in a basement, you tend to get sort of slightly smaller thoughts. Mm. If you're out in the desert, my favourite thing is on an aeroplane staring out of the window. That's the best place of all to do thinking, in my opinion.
And we've decided in this programme it's also a very good place to cry as well. Do you start to cry in planes?
I did blog that once, and then I deleted the post because I just felt really embarrassed having put it up there.
Well, it's interesting you say blog. I mean, are you sort of out there sort of blogging and tweeting, or are you retreating at the moment?
I'm retreating. I've never tweeted. I did actually, I must admit,
that as a confession.
I did get somebody to do it for me once, just an experiment, and I thought, God, this is awful, and I got rid of it. I'm not on Facebook or any of this stuff. I am slightly retreating. I'm going back to paper. I like public libraries. I'm not rejecting digital culture. You know, I'm not saying Google's evil. I just really think there needs to be a bit of balance, and the medium matters. You know, your mind is different looking at a screen to reading paper.
Mm. I just wonder, you know, obviously a lot of the book looks at kind of what's happening to young people and, you know, the kind of teenagers and things. And do you think there is going to be a generation that comes up through kind of culture and through kind of business, which actually isn't very good at thinking strategically or isn't very good at kind of planning or isn't very good at having these big ideas?
I think it's extremely dangerous to label generations, although I just have in the book. I think there's probably as much difference within these so-called generations as there is between them, but there does seem to be a difference. I mean, you know, my 8-year-old son thinks Google knows everything. He actually said, that was a quote, you know, Dad, don't you know Google knows everything? You know, it's a verb. It's always been around since he's been around. Mm. They live on screens. They don't use media. They inhabit it. They're constantly connected. You know, the first thing they'll do before they put their feet out of bed is check, you know, their phone or Facebook or something. So there are definitely differences. I mean, attention spans are different. Whether or not that balances itself, I'm not sure. I think it might. I mean, I think they've gone too far in terms of privacy online, and I think they'll pull that back a bit, whereas older generations haven't quite pushed it out that far.
Is there also danger, and sometimes we talk about it, not you know, we won't sort of name colleagues, but where it is generational, and I think one thing that we've noticed is that there seems to be an evaporation or a collapse of, let's say, quick recall general knowledge, because, well, I can just go and I can wiki it. And of course, you know, that Wikipedia's not always right either. But that idea of being able to name a national capital or attaching a national capital to a nation, just things that we grew up with, that's gone, at least with one portion of the generation we're talking about.
Yeah, I think that's definitely true. I mean, it's been referred to as just-in-time knowledge, and they will argue, well, why do I need to know this? I'll just Google it. And I can understand that to a point. I mean, you don't want to clutter your mind with too much stuff. But on the other hand, they're missing the broader context of things. And the attention span is a really big problem. I mean, I've spoken to 16-year-olds who have openly admitted they don't read books anymore. And I've sort of plugged away saying, well, why? And they've eventually admitted, well, you know, they're so, you know, long. It's just frightening.
Rob, I've heard you say that before as well.
I'm always saying that.
It's good for a culture editor.
First and last page. It's the page 99 test that we read about this week, actually. Richard, I want to talk about old and new brains, because you've written this book. You're the age of a man that can write a book about this with an element of hindsight. But are new brains, the brains of your son, for example, do you think they're a different piece of engineering now because of the media they're exposed to? And if it's exposed to something at that age, is he simply doing different things, and is he thinking genuinely differently to you, how you were at that age?
The simple answer is we don't know yet. I mean, most of this technology is too new. I mean, you know, most of this stuff, Google's what, 11 or 12 or something. Twitter's probably barely 5. YouTube's not much more than 10, even if that. So we need to see how this pans out, and we shouldn't sort of rush to making conclusions. Equally, we don't know enough about the human brain, although we're finding out more and more about it. All I can really talk about with any sort of real knowledge is what I'm doing and what, you know, people I know I'm doing. And my kids, yes, they are doing things differently. They read in a completely different way to the way I read. I read in a sort of linear way. I start top left and I go down the page, and if it's interesting, I carry on. They read in the same way they look at screens. They're looking for visual icons, and they jump around looking for sort of typeface changes, color changes, and they may or may not read the whole thing. And they'll probably get distracted halfway through anyway because a phone will go off or something like that. So I think it looks like it could be changing our brains.
I wanted to focus on opportunities, and you know, and within all of this, do you focus on where the business opportunities lie, whether they're for the tech companies or whether it's for the retailer on the street?
Yes and no. I mean, I think some of the opportunities I wouldn't necessarily agree with. I mean, some of the mobile phone companies talk about micro boredom as an opportunity, that spare 5 seconds you've got in between phone calls or sort of updating your Facebook account, which doesn't necessarily appeal to me. I think there are almost the other way. There are a lot of risks associated with the changing way we're thinking. I mean, we're becoming a lot more sort of shallow and less reflective, and that is causing mistakes. We're not planning ahead. I think where the opportunities are with organizations is to slightly retreat from it, or at least to rebalance. I think we need to restrict the flow. We need to sort of practice selective ignorance, if you like. We cannot keep up with all of this information. We need to disconnect occasionally. You just cannot constantly be connected with things going off. You have to have downtime. Your brain needs that. You know, we're not getting enough sleep. That's extremely important. We need to sort of visit certain places to actually help our thinking.
Where should we be going?
I think, my favourite places are sort of aeroplanes and trains, but we should be going to cathedrals, walking up mountains, going to beaches, lying in the bath is always a good one. I think we should go to lunch more. I'm a huge fan of lunch. We're not doing it enough.
I wondered, from what we talked about the genesis of the book at the beginning of the interview, but I wondered whether you genuinely approached the subject with an element of cynicism, or and saving your children from a lifetime of kind of 5 second attention spans, or whether it's more of a scientific study.
Probably neither. I mean, I'd love to sort of claim that I'm sort of doing this amazing experiment with my children. I'm not. I'm fighting them every day. They're addicted to various things, and we're seen as the worst parents in the world because we don't let them have stuff, and it's a constant argument. It's just something I've seen creeping up, and there's actually quite a lot of books coming out around this subject. So it's clearly, I'm not the only one that's thinking about this, and I just think it's not received enough discussion. There are some fantastic things about digital culture, and they're well known and they're talked about, but some of the potential downsides aren't receiving enough attention.
And can you see it in the culture? I mean, can you see books getting shorter, books that were in intended only to be online offerings, and films? Can you see things getting shorter, adopting the mannerisms and habits of the internet?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at media, it's getting snack-sized. And my favourite example of this is you can now actually buy executive summary versions of children's nursery rhymes for sort of multitasking toddlers and stressed executive parents, which is absolutely ridiculous.
So Mary Lamb, Fleece, Snow. You sort of get the idea, right?
Yeah, exactly. But only if you've read the original.
There's just sort of call-out boxes, as you say, with sort of exactly. Key points of the story. Yeah.
Richard, I wanted to ask you, do you think that there's a risk, though, that your book will be seen as just one of those generational books? You know, that when I was a kid, my parents were endlessly saying, if you watch more TV, I'm going to cut the plug off that TV and it's going and we'll never have it again. Or if you don't take your headphones off when you're listening to music, I've had enough of it. And I think that there is a kind of a generational thing where your parents feel...
Did they say you'd go blind?
They go, that was something else. But there is a kind of thing where there is that age gap, isn't there? Just people are scared of what their kids are doing, and they're scared of the kind of the worlds that they're inhabiting. You know, is it really as dangerous as we're kind of painting? I'm being a bit devil's advocate here because I think I can see the risk. But I just worry that it's a bit of a generational divide as well.
I think that's a very fair point. And I've had that thought in my mind throughout the whole thing. And you've got to be sort of very careful. I mean, I think we distrust anything that's invented after about 35 or 40. And we've had these arguments before. You know, books are going to destroy things when they're invented. We've had the same thing with radio and television and various forms of music. And I think that is partly true here. And this is a sort of generational angst thing to some extent. But I genuinely believe something deeper is happening here. And I don't think it's just, you know, people of a certain age.
And just jumping to the other side, it's something that, you know, we've noticed and we've debated within the office is a kind of, it's not an intellectual thing, but an emotional response to this, which is that often people who are used to getting, sending a message and getting it straight back on the internet or poking their friends and getting, you know, a response straight back, they find it very difficult when they're then suddenly in an office environment where they're disconnected from the kind of Facebook to kind of do a piece of work and actually maybe wait 2 or 3 days for someone to say whether they like it, or that they need that instantaneous reaction to everything they're doing. And I wondered if you felt that there was a kind of an emotional kind of world that was kind of, you know, being distorted by the internet.
I'm worried fundamentally about two things. One is essentially that a lot of this stuff is killing off deep thinking. I think it's also affecting human relationships, and it's back to this sort of immediacy thing, amongst other things. To some extent, a lot of younger people do want this sort of constant feedback, constant reward. And we have this weird situation. We are fantastically connected. There's something like 4.2 billion mobile phones out there. Yet a lot of the data says that actually we have fewer friends than we had 10 years ago. Currently, 25% of Americans claim to have no close friends. 10 years ago, it was only 10%. So we have all this fantastic connectivity, but we're sort of missing something. And I think that sort of connectivity is a little bit superficial, to be honest.
You mentioned America, which, you know, of course, which sort of brings up borders and national lines. And I'm wondering also, do you see that the world will be sort of an archipelago where there are very different things happening on different islands? And I think one thing that, you know, we talk about, you know, quite a bit is that, you know, everyone's sort of, you know, very, very obsessed about, you know, let's say the opposite side of the Atlantic is much more obsessed about the iPad than this side and Japan and elsewhere in the world as well. So do you think also that we're moving at different speeds too, that what's happening in South Korea is radically different and they've responded in a very different way than what's happening in the UK or Germany or Canada?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, if you look at Japan and South Korea in particular, they are way ahead of us, I think, with most of this stuff. And they're experiencing some of the problems that we haven't come across yet. I mean, you know, the recent example of a couple that spent so long raising an avatar child, their rear child died, which you probably read about. You know, they have internet addiction clinics in Korea. They've got cyberbullying units in police stations in Korea. We haven't really got any of this stuff yet. Now, it may be we never get it because it's particularly cultural, or it may be that they're just on the sort of the bleeding edge and we'll get it in 10, 15 years or something. But I think there are differences culturally.
Mm. Well, having spent time in South Korea...
A cyberbully hostel?
Yeah, and I've never got over those cyber tears. They've never really dried on my cyber cheek, my e-cheek. But I've found, I mean, I'm sure these things exist in South Korea, and it's fascinating, but I tended to think that people kind of, being there and being in Seoul, people kind of are always on some form of media, handheld media or whatever, and they're far more advanced than most of the things we have here. But it kind of brought people together, genuinely. People would be passing their phones around a group of people. It would be kind of like a sort of like a technological peace pipe in some kind of weird way. It wasn't like people were in their own little zone, which was kind of another thing, which was kind of another way of looking at it, I thought. I was kind of surprised to see quite how portable these things were and how they were shared around at the same time, yeah, which kind of made me feel quite positive about it.
I think that's true. I don't think you can make sort of categorical statements, but I mean, I am seeing some worrying things. I was in a sort of fun pub about a year ago in Yorkshire, and a couple in there, 30s, I guess, came in with a small girl who proceeded to sort of jump into the coloured balls bit. And they both took out PlayStations. And for about an hour and a half, they didn't speak to each other. They didn't recognise that their daughter was there. They were just engrossed there. There was no conversation. Or the other classic example was in Sydney. There's a restaurant called Icebergs overlooking Bondi. And we were sort of sitting there. And a couple came in their mid-20s and sat down. And he proposed to her. And they had a conversation which lasted about 30 minutes. And for the next hour and a bit, they were both on mobile phones telling all their friends about what had happened. They didn't actually exchange a single word. Now, I kind of hope their relationship lasts a bit longer than their sort of initial conversation. I just wonder where some of this stuff goes, really.
The book is called Future Minds. It's out, obviously, UK, the Commonwealth world, USA, I would imagine.
Yeah, Australia, New Zealand, US, Canada.
And what about Japan and Korea?
Coming soon. It's being translated.
Right. Okay, excellent. Thank you very much, Richard Watson. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks for inviting me over.
You're listening to The Monocle Weekly. We're back in a moment. Welcome back to The Monocle Weekly, where it's time for Comment Corner, which is also known as... What is it, Rob?
Monologue.
Yep, absolutely. That's what it is.
And who's in the comment corner?
Comment corner, or writing the monologue today, is our writer and cub reporter. Is he a cub reporter? Or has he graduated from cub status?
He's a little bear now.
Little bear. Jonathan Openshaw. He's been on the road to Damascus. He's been in Beirut. Here's what he has to say.
The soundtrack to Beirut is changing fast, with the Islamic call to prayer being drowned out by the noise of pneumatic drills and the inexorable churning of Middle Eastern cement mixers. For the casual tourist, perhaps still harbouring hopes of discovering an exotic Paris of the Levant, a Mediterranean coastline of Venetian-style villas and walled gardens infused with a hint of Ali Baba's Arabian Nights, this may seem to be a national catastrophe. Long-term Beirut residents would be quick to remind these romanticists, myself included here, that the sound of construction is a big improvement on that of mortar shells and gunfire, however. Beirut is no stranger to spatial transformation. From Italian to Ottoman or Art Deco to Neo-Orientalist, diverse architectural visions have played out across the city for hundreds of years. It's not just architects that have vied for dominance in Lebanon, of course, and in 1975, the social hotpot that once made Beirut a poster child for multiculturalism exploded into a civil war that destroyed the fabric of a city as well as a society. Combine this with the earthquakes that have flattened Beirut on several occasions during its 5,000-year history, and it's easy to see why the city has become known as a phoenix of the Levant, constantly reinventing itself even after the most devastating of events. Having said this, the wave of development since the 1990s feels unprecedented. Real estate now stands as the country's second biggest economic sector, with growth forecasts and construction topping 14% next year. This building boom was initially kicked off by an inflow of cash from the considerable Lebanese diaspora. 10 million people scattered from New York to Nairobi, all keen to invest in the future prosperity of their motherland. It has since been joined by huge private wealth funds from across the Middle East, however, and talking to local residents, there's a growing concern that a construction boom that once held the promise of future recovery is becoming an uncontrollable force threatening to swallow the city's past. With Dubai standing as a reminder of the perils of unchecked development without a local flavour, Beirutis have good reason to be afraid. Sitting in the rooftop gardens of the Alboga Hotel in Ashrafieh one balmy evening last week, looking out over the skyscraper-studded skyline, it felt like the city was still at war. It's just the tools that have changed. Entire districts, such as the central souks and the Hezbollah-occupied Danya suburb, were reduced to rubble during the 15 years of conflict, and they obviously needed rebuilding. But it's the few intact historic areas, such as Jemaisi and Ashrafieh, that are now at risk. Walk along the winding alleys of blue enamel street signs and classic Lebanese townhouses, and these neighbourhoods conjure up a former way of life. For a country where social and political divisions remain very present, a stronger sense of communal history could prove invaluable. Honking our way through the city traffic in a cigarette smoke-filled taxi, a starkly divided vision of Beirut's future passes by outside. At the centre, you have private development company Solidaire's reimagining of the city souks, a choreographed Disneyland of perfect sandstone buildings and roadside fountains. Drive a little further out, however, and you enter the free-for-all of concrete and steel developments, unchecked by government planning restrictions and dictated only by how to make the most money out of a plot of land. A two-tiered city is emerging then, the saccharine centre surrounded by a jumble sale of poorly planned concrete suburbs. This transformation has many Beirutis, from architects to university students, questioning the real cost of recovery, but with a venal outlook dominating Lebanese politics, it will be an uphill struggle to check the rate of destruction. Boarding my Middle East Airlines flight bound for London, the imagined smells of geraniums and incense had been replaced by that of diesel and concrete dust. Perhaps more than anywhere else in the world, Beirut feels like a city in the process of deciding its future. There's no room for romantic imaginings of a lost way of life in the cut and thrust of this booming city, and its ambitions mustn't be curbed by a prescriptive notion of tradition. But in their eagerness to embrace the future, it feels like Beirut's politicians have lost sight of the past. For Monocle, I'm Jonathan Openshaw.
And just delivered fresh off the conveyor belt at Heathrow, here's Jonathan Openshaw. Right off your MEA flight. Isn't MEA great?
It's fantastic. Amazing.
Yeah. Three cheers for MEA. Ooh. Rob, you'd love it.
Would I?
Yeah, you would.
Is it old school?
It is old school. And we haven't plugged the airline enough. It's all eyeliner and lips and and lots of various kind of augmentation.
They're not sending cars, are they?
No, they're not. Well, they should actually. Could be sort of a new sideline for them. It was a beautiful, Jonathan Openshaw, it was a beautiful piece.
Bravo. Thank you so much. That was amazing. I learned a lot about that.
But I don't think you did any of it. I think the only noise you heard was the noise of out of the speakers at Skybar. Because I hadn't even seen Jonathan. And all I ever see, because he was, we should say, in our upcoming issue, we have a survey of Lebanon coming up, our first national survey of the autumn. And all I heard was from some friends involved in architecture firm who were involved with Skybar, just said that, Jonathan was a hit. So yeah. There you go, Andrew.
I did get a kind of text from him one day, and it said, at Skybar, giant bottles of vodka. And I text it back, that's not on expenses, I hope.
No, that's the extraordinary thing, though, because the last time that we were in Beirut, it was the trip before I was with Jonathan, and I think there were about sort of seven or eight of us out there when we launched Mediterraneo. I mean, the Jeroboams and Magnums and sort of the 5-liter bottles of champagne just kept coming and coming.
Yeah.
And there was never a bill.
Definitely does overflow. Yeah. I know I was enjoying my serious correspondent voice in that dispatch, but obviously a lot of the there's the lighter side of Beirut as well, which is fun.
How was the survey tour? Don't give too much away.
Okay, it was good. But yeah, as a little taster, it was it was an amazing, just a fascinating week. Our correspondent out there, Carol, was brilliant, and she obviously has all, she's her family have been there since the Crusades, probably, and she has all the contacts you can imagine. So, yeah, and it was brilliant, just really getting under the skin of the country.
Now, I think she has some aunties and relatives, you know, who have literally are still around since the Crusades as well. I mean, there's the most extraordinary sort of galaxy of relatives that she had that are just sort of perfectly preserved, which is remarkable.
Well, I've been reading all the pages for the survey, and what I think is one of the many amazing things about it is just that level of connection between families and banks and, you know, the developers, which you can only get really through having an amazing correspondent there and then you having our team there. It's something I'm really looking forward to seeing published.
Rob, I can see you putting your head up. I know we're going to get you out there, but we've offered you at 3 trips.
I know, and what's wrong with
it? Oh, it's like, then I've got to go to Italy, and then I've got to go to Italy again.
Ooh, I haven't got any socks.
Yeah.
I haven't got any socks. Got any shoes now and trousers. It's fine. I wanted to ask Jonathan a question about Beirut.
Go for it.
And I like the way, I also like the way in the his essay there we just heard that he had to define it as a cigarette smoke.
Yes. There's definitely not hashish.
Cigarette smoke in the taxi.
Yeah. Yeah. Could have been a shisha. There could have been a shisha
in the
back seat.
That's what I was thinking. Yeah, exactly.
I wondered
about the history. Do people kind of enthrall of the history of that city, or are they really trying to make a buck? And are they, does the sort of strange political situation where you might get a rocket over your wall the next day, does that sort of change people's attitude to the history, make them care about it less or more?
Yeah. No, I think it's an interesting one. I mean, there's an extremely complicated relationship to what makes people Lebanese, I think. And on one hand, so talking about architecture and the kind of building regulations, they have certain things kind of really thoroughly enshrined in law, like their kind of ancient history, Baalbek, Roman ruins. They're great at kind of recognising there's that legacy. But the more kind of recent things, there's lots of the protection legislation was kind of made in the 1920s, and so doesn't actually take the buildings that were being made in the 1920s as their object. And so there's this whole kind of almost blank spot to the rich history that we, you know, going over there as having only been there once before as a kind of tourist, see as this kind of amazing, rich thing that needs to be preserved. There's not a strong sense of that being an important thing to...
I mean, you do get the sense as well that things could really kick off, because you have, you know, and as you were saying in your piece, you've just got these wonderful sort of townhouses.
All that booze.
Exactly. But, you know, you have these wonderful, and you reference sort of Jemaisie and Ashrafieh, you have these wonderful villas and incredible townhouses, and also sort of, you know, very nice low-rise apartments. And then you have these, they are monstrosities going up in front. I mean, you know, better than monstrosities elsewhere. I mean, I think they haven't gone too far down the road of sort of, you know, Dubaiism, which is a good thing. There's some level of respect because they've chosen the right stone, etc. But nevertheless, they're 43 stories and they're casting shadows and blocking views. And, you know, once upon a time, you were just a toddler at this point, but, you know, the rooftop of, you know, the albergo, you could sort of properly see the sea. And now it's sort of blocked by all those towers in the front. And, yeah. And that's all gone, which is unfortunate.
Yeah, there's a real wall coming up along the coast.
Yeah.
I think there's two little funny, interesting things. Is one is which is the buildings put up in the 70s, which aren't that beautiful often, but they have these amazing kind of gardens or kind of green fronts and the amount of plants and things that people grow in them. But the funny thing is about lots of the new buildings going up is that if you have a plot of land, you literally want to build on every inch of it. So people build up to their neighbours. You know, so their neighbours are opening a window and it's like 6 inches away is the new apartment block. There's no kind of zoning to kind of force people to leave, you know, X percentage of a plot free as green space. Yeah. They just really kind of encroach on each other in a kind of slightly intimidating way.
And that's the thing with developments in places like Ashrafieh, where there's these tiny little lanes and they're leaving no room between buildings, is that you have kind of these 30-store apartment blocks springing up in places that have 8-foot-wide lanes to serve them. So it's almost like people have the building boom so overexcited that people have forgotten the overview and thinking about the planning aspect is kind of almost completely gone. It's almost like, how can you make the most out of a plot of land? And it's forgetting the city as an overall...
I haven't read any of the Lebanese pages yet from the survey, but are these some of your recommendations, though, I would say?
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, we've got a great selection, I think.
Excellent. Well, that's all for this week's edition of The Monocle Weekly. Today's show was produced by Alex Mills, and our sound engineer, as ever, was Chris Sharp here at the Sound Company in London. If you have any thoughts or comments for today's show, then do drop us a note to weekly@monocle.com. And remember, you can catch up with us daily via our monocolumn on our site. Next week I think we're supposed to be here in London, but... I believe if I look at my schedule from Tuesday onwards, I don't think we're going to be doing a show on Monday or Tuesday. I'm in Scandinavia, so I have a feeling the next week's show could be coming from Helsinki or Stockholm.
Ah, a bit Nordic.
I don't know, or maybe we're co-anchoring it. You guys might be here, I might be there. far side of the Baltic.
I've got a water ski. I'll see you there.
What? Should we do a poll? Where would you prefer to do the show? Should we do the show from London? Well, I can't come back, so it's Helsinki or Stockholm.
Stockholm.
Stockholm is good for me.
Stockholm is good for you. Good. And also you sort of do a bit of a wardrobe top-up as well. I mean, not that you need one. I mean, you look very dashing today. But I haven't seen you sort of throwing around a lot of new looks yet.
I'm saving them.
Okay, good.
For what, though?
Exactly. That's what we want to know.
That's the problem.
There's
going
to be a whole makeover.
I know, you've got some fancy socks on. Anyway, next week, we're probably in Stockholm. We could be in London, you never know. But for now, I'm Tyler Brulé.
I'm Andrew Tuck.
I'm Robert Band.
I'm Jonathan Openshaw.
More next week. Goodbye.